Stardate 96819.68. My name's Mike Moody, and you are listening to Star Trek Discovery Pod. I have not a full crew with me today, just my wingman.
Slim Pickens. That's my name. I'm your wingman. I'm going to talk like this the whole time.
The captain is here with the red shirt, Grant Davis. How's it going, Grant Davis?
Howdy, howdy. I am happy to be here with you. I think that everyone else who is missing out, those people being Mariah and Clyde, are going to be kicking themselves because this episode was holy shit.
We are in agreement. This episode was indeed holy shit.
No, it's higher pitched.
No.
I like that you had said, you were like, can I do it? And you're like, not going to try.
You know I'm drinking tea for a reason here. My voice is fucked. But I'm here. I'm excited to talk about episode 10 of season 2 of Star Trek Discovery, The Red Angel, written by Chris Silvestri and Anthony Maranville, and directed by Handel M. Culpepper. I'm already losing my voice. So if you're listening to us for the first time, we are a Star Trek Discovery podcast. We review every episode of Star Trek Discovery from a critical and a fan perspective. There's usually four of us here, and two of us have the week off. Let's just say that.
They're on away missions.
That's what we say.
Yeah, we usually just say that because it's none of your business, guys.
By the way, Clyde, who isn't here tonight, is texting me all of his thoughts on tonight's episode while I'm trying to record.
Tough shit, Clyde. Either you show up to the studio to record or you don't get to have an opinion.
Your opinions are invalid, Clyde. Staying up all night writing a slash fic. All right. Visit us at StarTrekPod.com. You can find all of our episodes there. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere you get the podcast. And if you really, really want to help us out, we would love it if you went to
Patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Please go to Patreon.com/StarTrekPod to make your per episode donation. This podcast that we do is a labor of nerdy, nerdy love. And we are proud to do it, and we would probably do it for free. But you know what makes it so much sweeter is when you, the listener, love what you're hearing, and you actually want to help support people that make stuff that you love. We are one of those people, and all you have to do is give us a dollar or two an episode, and it really helps keep this ship afloat and allow us to continue to grow and do more things. And I do want to say that if you guys give that $2 an episode donation, you not only get access to bonus exclusive content, we do little minis here and there, but also you get access to our private Slack channel. Please go there to discuss after every episode with us all your theories and just chat with other like-minded Trekkies. It's a lot of fun. And Mike, there's one more thing I wanted to point out. Did you know, my friend, that there are 14 episodes this season? Ask me how I know this.
You know what? That fact is drilled into my brain now. But how do you know this?
Well, it turns out in our last episode, we were under the misunderstanding that there are potentially only 11 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Chalk this up to checking out, I don't know, Wikipedia or whatever. Some of these sites just weren't listing all the episodes. They're listing what has been released, what details have been released online thus far.
Yeah, every online source that I checked, and I at least checked one.
Well, that's,
said 11.
That's your due diligence.
Right, yeah. I mean, doing my work.
But there's a person on Twitter, a Mr. @AlbinoKid.
@AlbinoKid. That sounds familiar.
Who did point out to us, hey, fellas, just want to let you know that there are 14 episodes this season, not 11. So don't be spreading rumors that are false and having people just check out after episode 11.
Hey, Star Trek Pod, no fake news, please.
Yeah, exactly. And yep. AlbinoKid, you guys might also know as Commander Stamets.
Anthony Rapp.
Is it Commander? Lieutenant Commander?
Lieutenant Commander Stamets.
Lieutenant Commander Stamets.
Let's be safe and just say Stamets.
Yeah. What's his rank? I don't know.
Okay.
Yep. So he called us out, put us on blast, and as I later tweeted, I'm used to our Trekkie fans calling us out, just not this Trekkie fan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, man.
He was actually pretty nice about it. I tweeted back. I'm like, hey, thanks for the clarification. And he was like, hey, it's all good. Still love you, so.
He didn't say still love you.
He did.
in your slash fic alongside Clyde.
In Clyde's slash fic. All right. Well, thank you, Rap, again. Well, it's time for some hot takes.
Hot takes!
All right. You know what? I want to hear your hot take because you're burning hot to talk about this episode. I know you liked it.
Man, this episode, there's these certain episodes where there's a slow buildup. They want to just keep cultivating the mystery. And then there's those ones where they're like, we're just ripping off the Band-Aid. We're telling you this mystery and that mystery. We're just letting everything happen. We're going to build up to a climax. We're going to have an emotional release. Everything is just going to work out, and it's going to be super exciting the entire time. And that was this episode. This one was nonstop excitement. And, man, was I impressed with what Sonequa Martin-Green had to do this episode and how she just carried the team in this episode. It was just really powerful, really emotional, and really exciting to the point where I was like, oh man, I have to remember to breathe during the climax at the very end of this episode. I'm like, no, oh, that's really intense.
I feel the same way. I like that we got a lot of answers, and they just kept coming and coming and coming. And the pace was extremely frenetic, but that's been an issue for me all this season, but for some reason I was so engaged in this episode. There was so much going on, and it was happening so quickly. I was so engaged, and I didn't mind the fact that those dominoes were falling second by second so quickly. I liked the frenetic pace here. It didn't bother me. Usually that's something that bothers me.
Yeah, no, they were just tossing out answers to mysteries left and right, and me just going, okay, I guess. What are you going to give me? And then they're like, oh, also, we're going to give you, like, we're going to dangle this sort of like, hey, what if we tried to catch the Red Angel? I'm like, right, that's not going to work. And then they straight up do it.
Yep.
And then they reveal who the Red Angel is. Like, they just kept giving us everything.
And there was some really great emotional moments between Burnham and Spock, who they finally came to an understanding. And even though I like some of the emotional stuff that was going on in this episode, and I like some of it that was happening at the beginning with the memorial for Arium that opened the show.
Right.
I think that memorial did kind of tip into being a little overbearing.
A little sappy.
Mainly because we didn't get to know her a lot, and there's this big procession for her. But
it was a soapbox off for everyone to kind of...
Yeah.
We'll get into that in a minute, but
yeah,
there were some things I was laughing at.
But, I mean, the way everything... one of the best things about this was the Spock-Burnham dynamic. There were some really well-acted scenes between them in this.
Right.
Like when they're first kind of giving each other shit back and forth. Those are really fun. But there's some wonderfully deep moments with them together here as the episode goes on. They start having this shared trauma that they can bond over. I think they came to a place where, as a fan, I wanted to see that relationship go. Really appreciated that.
It was an absolute necessary transition for Spock because I was starting to refer to him as Mock lately because like it just seems like everything he does is he's just mocking Burnham. And I was like, all right, at a certain point, I want to see that more, I want, for lack of a better word, human side of you where you do start empathizing with her rather than just giving her shit because Burnham's gone through a bunch of shit and she doesn't need more grief from you.
Well, she is the center of the universe. Everything happens because of her and everything's about her.
Thanks for that. Thanks for telling everyone that. Spock. Yeah. I appreciate it.
It's fine.
But I thought that Burnham also got a lot of like powerful moments that were kind of lingering under the surface and needed to be addressed with a couple characters. There was her relationship with Ash, which I admit in the beginning of this episode, I was a little bit lukewarm to as well. I was like, I don't know about Ash. You just leave that dude. He's trouble.
Do you want Ash and Burnham to be together?
Kind of do.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I feel like she just... she needs someone.
Is it?
And he shows that compassion for her that she needs.
I think so. I think they really care about each other. He comforted her so much in this episode when she really needed it. But is it dumb that Section 31 is that wall? Is that wall that's between them? It feels so forced.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit arbitrary. But her relationship also with Georgiou. There was this one moment where Georgiou turns off the snark and actually has like a genuine, sincere moment. And it's two people that are remembering the alternate versions of the other and and feeling a powerful connection to that. But I think in a way, the relationship between these two has progressed to a degree where you can start to see that they're starting to feel a certain degree of care for each other. And that is even more significant for Georgiou to open up to actually giving a shit about other people.
Yeah. Does it feel like a genuine softening of Georgiou for you, or does it feel forced?
I thought how that was executed, that it was beautiful.
Yeah.
It's that pause where she actually bites her tongue and doesn't follow through with another line of snark and instead actually has a genuine, sincere moment with her. And it felt totally earned.
Right. I agree. Well, let's jump through the plot of this episode.
So we're going to start with the eulogy.
We open on an upbeat.
Yeah. You might call it that.
We begin mourning Arium, honoring her sacrifice. This should feel kind of hollow for me, and some of it did, and some of it kind of, you know, long and cheesy. But for the most part, I think it worked. I really liked this show has gone out of its way recently, and sometimes it gets a little heavy-handed to underline the morals and values of what Star Trek is and what the Federation is. Oh, Arium fought to live, and she sacrificed herself for us. And, you know, there was a lot of characters... You know,
oh, plot standing, device was so noble.
Characters standing on these platitudes that have been repeated over and over throughout the series. Some of it really worked for me. Some of it didn't. So
does it get old for you?
50-50.
I was kind of warmed to it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, some of it, maybe if it was cut down by 40%, I would have really, less is more, you know?
Well, I thought that Pike starting the whole thing, sure, he's the captain of the ship. But it was a little bit weird because I'm like, you're also the new kid on the block. You didn't really know her to the extent that a lot of these other people, these other people had a relationship. And at first I was like, is it just going to be him talking? And luckily it transitioned and a bunch of people, you know, started like sharing some of their thoughts and perspective. Mm-hmm. We got some of our favorites, like, you know, Tilly saying something. But I was also really struck by Detmer, her note that she was talking about how Arium, like, really taught her that, you know, augmentations don't make you different. They make you into something new. And that was pretty thematically relevant to a lot of notes that we've been seeing throughout this season with, especially Ash Tyler dealing with, you know, I'm not a monster. I'm just something new. And Culber also dealing kind of with the same thing. And Saru also dealing with the same thing. Like, all these characters are evolving and not just like an emotional character arc growth kind of way, but like a physical transformation is happening for a lot of them, which really matches with this augmentation idea. Saru having his ganglia fall off and a brand new scarless body for Culber, and like all of it just seems so relevant. And I like how they find ways to thread all of these together and have a commentary that's indirect but so relevant.
You know, this show must have a lot of theme meetings behind the scenes.
Just these theme boards.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not even a joke. I'm sure they do, because they really do weave these human themes throughout this entire series, and they're repeated over and over, and they get deeper.
Identity and duality.
Right.
And
and it's done really elegantly for the most part. And it, I really liked Kayla's piece here during the memorial. I really liked Tilly's as well. You might not remember this, but, well, you haven't seen Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, but... Mm-hmm. Some of Tilly's speech here when saying goodbye to Arium, actually it was at the end of Star Trek II, echoed some of the stuff Kirk said about Spock when Spock dies, spoiler, in Star Trek
II. You were the most human? Was that it?
She was my friend.
Oh, she was my friend.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's almost word for word.
I want to talk real quick about Stamets. His eulogy kind of amused me because...
What did he say? I don't remember.
He was making good dual use of his eulogy. And basically...
He's like, this is about Colbert.
Yeah, it's basically like how the camera shows Colbert while he's talking about like losing a loved one.
Oh, sure.
A little bit heavy-handedly and like just like the furtive glances over there. I was like... That's a way to use your eulogy platform.
Yeah.
To also so a little bit of guilt.
The writers did a high five when they wrote that one.
Yeah.
I did like that, you know, a lot of these episodes have been beginning with voiceovers that seem a little forced, but I like that this episode started with layers of, you know, not necessarily layers of voiceover, but layers of characters, you know, talking at us.
Yeah.
It was the same but different.
When we saw Kayla giving her eulogy, I thought, oh, good. This might be just one of those great devices that allows us to get more of the background characters. But really, it was just hers.
Yeah.
and it was very welcome.
Yeah. They're not going to let the bughead lady in the back talk.
No. But Burnham bringing it home and like tying in the ideals of Starfleet. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty good. Also, she got to have like the biggest emotional moment, it seemed, like her crying, and I was like, oh man. You actually got to have a good emotional scene in the episode. Little did I realize she's gonna be crying through this whole episode because of a bunch of shit hitting the fan for
her. It's gonna be 9 more emotional scenes for her.
Yeah.
Do you think Doug Jones sang that song of remembrance?
I don't know. It was pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to think he did. Actors all, like, you know, got a bunch of mad skills. And
I liked it. It helped everything get back because it ended on that note with him singing. Mm-hmm. And any of the somewhat cheesiness I felt in this scene, that brought it back home for me. It felt more grounded, and it felt kind of like BSG, Battlestar.
There was this scene they showed while everyone was talking where they're combing through the memories of Arium's body, of the corpse, and deleting those memories. And I thought that was an interesting little addition there. Like this idea that the mortuary for a cyborg who stores memories would be an honorable thing, would be to take and remove those so those can't be extracted and used later after their death.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like one of those really thoughtful things, sci-fi things that I wouldn't really ever consider otherwise.
Yeah, I thought the same way. And then I was thinking about it a little more, and I was like, does she have any family who would want those memories? But I guess that would maybe violate something, wouldn't it, if they gave it to someone else?
Right.
If they gave that flash drive with all of her private memories to someone else, even if it was someone who loved her and wants to remember her.
You're right.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's weird. Like, mm-hmm. what are the ethics behind, mm-hmm. like, pouring through what stored memories a cyborg has?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like Minority Report in a way. Like, can you see how someone died like that and use that evidence? Or is that unethical for you to comb through their memories and see who murdered them?
Yeah. But it was a nice, you know, visual moment. And again, it hit that theme of this person has really passed.
Yeah. And it felt like it was handled respectfully.
So, during all this, they're uncuffing Ash and letting him out of his room.
Yeah.
Finally, they're like, sorry, our bad. It wasn't you. And then, we talked about it a little bit, but, you know, we kind of start to get a reconciliation of Ash and Burnham.
You know, it seemed weird for Ash to, like, hop on the elevator with Burnham right after that funeral.
Hey, we got to get through this episode, and man. Let's do it.
Hey, is this, like, talk about so many different moments in this episode where people are like, is this the best time for us to try and have, like, an emotional reconnection?
Like Stamets and Colbert later?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, Colbert is like, I kind of want to talk to you about this. And like, are you fucking kidding? We're about to sacrifice Burnham over here. This is not the best time.
We're going to save the universe now. Just give me a minute.
Yeah. Pick a little bit of a different opportunity.
And then we jump to a Next Generation style roundtable discussion where we get a lot of exposition.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine. I love Tilly's joke about the doors. Like, oh, these doors just open on their own. I'm in Star Trek, guys. I can't knock on the door.
And as always, Tilly starts rambling, and Pike just has no patience for it. He shuts her down every time she goes, all right, just get to the point. What do you want?
What do you think?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Come on, get with it.
So we learn that there's a bio-neural signature of the Red Angel, and of course, Tilly finds it, because Tilly finds everything. Mm-hmm. And it's Michael. We learned this in the cold open that the Red Angel is supposedly Michael.
I actually wrote it down. I'm like 8.5 minutes in, and they just straight up say, Michael's a Red Angel.
Before the credits, did you buy this? Because it was, I mean, we watch so much TV, and black alerts were just going off in my head. I'm like, this is a twist. This is a fake out. This is not going to be Michael.
I
was hoping it would be, because imagine how interesting that would be if she met her future self, and maybe if the real Michael died and was replaced by this travel-weary, time-traveling Michael for the rest of the series. Like, that was an exciting thought.
You were skeptical right away.
I was pretty skeptical, but I was still entertaining, you know.
I was buying into it because I feel like there's been in television a bit of a backlash to the idea of the reveal and then the twist.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not a backlash by the audience so much as like the writers. They don't want to always have to also anticipate or deliver a weird twist for an audience. But maybe they also want to just jump the gun and be like, we suspect that you're already starting to piece together this stuff and you probably have already guessed it's Michael. So we're going to outright say, it's Michael. That's her bio signature. It can't be anyone else. Now, here's my question to you. Does her mom have the exact same bio signature as her?
She shouldn't, right? Unless Tilly, saw some of the same genes in whatever she was looking at and just got really excited and ran to go tell everybody and didn't do her due diligence. But that doesn't sound like Tilly.
I mean, they brought in a broken and psychologically unstable doctor to verify all the information.
A mushroom tier doctor.
Colbert.
That was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Let's bring in Colbert, even though he's not working right now. And he's severely fucked up. And we have another doctor because, the fans like him.
Basically, I love how they do that in that one scene. They're like, we're going to do this one-off, this one time where we let you do some doctorly things because, you know, you had some free time. And then later they're like, all right, audience, look, he's just a part of the team now. He's our main doctor. Yeah. Just move on.
He's putting on a spacesuit. He's going off-world. Yeah, we're damaging him more. It's fine.
Also, we're going to have him work side-by-side with his husband/ex.
Right.
And they're going through some fucked up stuff, but, you know, mission is important.
And there's no counselor aboard to help him, but maybe there is. We'll get to that in a little bit.
Right.
So, yeah, Colbert's reinstated, and we present this idea of the Red Angel to Michael and Spock's there.
I love how he's just calling out her savior complex to everyone.
Yeah.
He's like, surely everyone in this room has recognized her weird-ass savior complex. What the fuck is up with that? And she's like, come on, dude. These are my friends. This is my ship.
You know, her sense of having to shoulder the universe's burden is way out of proportion with reality, guys. I mean, look at her. Come on.
Yeah, right.
And Colbert and Pike's reaction is like, fuck, she burned you.
Yeah, they're like, that's not actually far off.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Spock, can you stick around?
And it's funny because it was, when I saw Pike's face, it was very much him recognizing his old friend Spock.
It's right.
Yep. This guy can be perceived as a dick, but he's just a logical Vulcan.
That's my dick.
Yep.
So they mentioned, they don't waste too much time questioning whether or not Burnham is the Red Angel.
No.
They take the data and they go, well, if that's what it says, that's what it says. So, okay, fine. I guess somehow she is. But then they ask the same question that we've been asking for the past few weeks, if not 5 or 6 weeks of this show. What is the significance of these different planets or different events where the Red Angels popped up.
Right.
And it was the asteroid Terra Elysium and Kaminar. Although Spock basically was like,
the commonality is that you're there. And I was like, well, that doesn't really apply to Terra Elysium, where she appeared in the past to save that entire planet of people and transport them to the future. And then they saw the video evidence of that.
But maybe
she can also appear elsewhere. But it was the grandfather paradox. Like, she has to save herself or else she can't come back from the future.
Dude, I just watched this 10 minutes ago.
Is it too heavy?
Let's just say it worked for me.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Okay, so I thought it was kind of ridiculous when Section 31 just saunters in there and then just drops all this information about what Project Daedalus is. And they're like, oh, hey, this is going to be a little bit heavy, but that Red Angel thing, we created it.
This is the moment where I realize, wow, this episode is fucking crazy. It's a mess. It's like, okay, hey guys, Burnham's a Red Angel. Hey, by the way, 5 seconds later, Section 31 shows up to fill in more information to let us know that they're Project Daedalus and what is happening now. And we're not even 15 minutes into the episode. I was so engaged and wanting these answers and loving that all these dominoes are being knocked down and I was getting all the answers I wanted. And we're being led to a hopefully surprising, interesting ending here that I didn't mind it.
It's bonkers.
It's bonkers.
It does remind me of Lost when they would just drop all this stuff in a penultimate episode. And if this was a penultimate episode, you know what? This kind of fits.
Yeah.
This is just one of those balls of walls, over-the-top, crazy episodes where like all this stuff is happening. And speaking of bad timing, wouldn't it be great for Leland to also be like, oh, you know, a lot of shit's going on, but I guess this is the time when I should really confide in Burnham that I kind of helped get her parents killed. Yeah, sure. Why don't we drop that information right now?
Why not?
Why not?
Wow.
Is the problem. Everyone says, why not? And maybe they should explore that a little more and go, here's why, and this one, this.
It's like the writers of this episode were agreeing with Giorgio when she's like, we like to throw in little totalitarian edge here every now and then.
Right. Yeah, I liked that.
Just to crush it.
What a great line.
I like how Cornwall was like, when Section 31 shows up, she's like, you guys are going to help. I'm cringing already.
So they want to set up a Ghostbusters trap, basically.
Yeah.
Because busting makes them feel good.
Well, they call it a mouse trap, but I like the Ghostbusters trap. It was totally a
Ghostbusters thing by the end once we saw it, right?
Totally, yeah. So, yeah, apparently Section 31, or what's the captain's name?
Leland.
Said the Klingons were researching time travel, possibly a reference to our favorite
show Enterprise.
Show Enterprise, because there was like a temporal arms race or a temporal war that involved different races, including the Klingons. Don't quote me on that. Enough about Enterprise. But apparently, Section 31 created the Red Angel suit as a time travel suit. They called it the Daedalus Project. It is a Red Angel, but the Klingon spies destroyed it before it was ready, and they also killed Burnham's parents, who had a completely separate, secret life that she didn't know about, and apparently she had nothing to do with her death because she, like she's wont to do, was taking that burden upon herself because she wanted to hang out in that planet and watch a star go supernova.
Right.
And they wanted to leave, apparently, but they couldn't because she wanted to watch it. So then the Klingons attacked and she died, so she blamed herself, but it wasn't her fault. It was, what's his name's fault?
Let's say, everyone can share some blame.
Okay.
The universe is large, Mike. And yet so small that everything, in a way, does circle around Burnham. And so, Spock being dismissive.
She's Harry Potter.
Yeah, she is. Everything gravitates to her. This is her story, and I still love it.
Yeah.
I thought it was weird, though, that they present this mousetrap solution. And given the distrust that's been sown between our disco boys and Section 31. Why is it that they're all like, yeah, we're on board. We're going to help you. Sure. I'm like, wait, aren't we not getting along here because you guys keep burning each other?
The fate of the universe. The fate of the universe is at stake.
Also, Can I ask a bigger question? If we are taking at face value that this is Michael Burnham in, as the Red Angel with a mission trying to go back and have them go to these different planets for the sake of humanity, what the fuck is their ego trip that they're like, no, we know better than this future time traveler. We're going to capture her and interrogate her rather than just do what she's saying.
I was
like, wouldn't Burnham trust future Burnham? Wouldn't you trust future you?
My brain was split in half during this episode. Part of me was, as a viewer, as someone who wants answers, yes, let's catch the Red Angel. If it's Michael, whoever, let's put her in this mousetrap.
As
let's sit her down.
As a person who wants the better plot, I'm on board.
Yes.
I'm like, yeah, catch her.
Of course.
But logically,
that doesn't
make sense.
Right. And you think, I mean, even Spock could have said, this is a bad idea.
The most logical thing is if it is Michael Burnham and she's from the future and knows more than us, we should just follow her and trust that she's going to lead us in the correct direction, as our current Michael Burnham always seems to do, except for in this instance where Michael Burnham is facing off against Michael Burnham.
But not.
And only Michael Burnham can screw over Michael Burnham.
You got a Michael Burnham if you Michael Burnham. Oh, Lord.
That's the saying.
Well, it made no sense. I mean, a lot of this episode was very much, we know what the viewers want, what the fans want. We're going to go in that direction with the plot, with bringing Colbert on as much as he was, with Giorgio kind of softening a little bit and being part of the team.
I just didn't think that that our disco crew would be like, oh, yeah, Saru, we'll go with Leland, and Giorgio will go talk to Stamets and Tilly and figure out, okay, wait, they're going to go figure out, she's going to drop this heavy knowledge on them, and then what, 30 minutes later, they're going to put together some PowerPoint presentation for her where they're like,
right,
look, we figured it out. Here's how it all works, and we're just going to build this contraption. I mean, go Team Science Fair, but how the hell did they do that?
Who cares? Because we got a great scene where
I know
Giorgio does everything within her evil, you know, dictator power to make Stamets feel extremely unnerved. And talks about, you know,
his neurosis
and that is trying to manipulate his relationship with Colbert.
He's a pansexual in the
right.
other version.
Yeah.
Like her. Yeah.
Yeah. But she also kind of brought out the best in him too, because he was doubting himself, you know, and she's like, no, you're smarter. You can do this. So
right?
It was interesting.
I mean,
and funny.
She made him cling to his convictions a bit.
Right.
In more than one way. And maybe that was a strength of her manipulation, that she knows that she can play the villain that can bring other people together in a way that will make them more efficient. I don't know if that's her master plan.
I mean, it's not super smart to say that she's always up to something, but she's up to something.
Right. She's Benjamin Linus.
Yeah. When, especially, like, you know, She's clearly got her eye on Colbert here for some reason. She was looking at him sideways a few times. She was liking the way her manipulation of Stamets made him react. She called him papi, which I enjoyed as a Latinx dude.
You and I are on different page there.
Yeah, I know.
When she plays on them sexually,
yeah,
those scenes just feel so weird and out of place to me that I go,
that's the point.
I go, wait, what's going on with this episode?
Yeah, that's the point. She's,
I don't
know.
It,
you know,
it pulls me out. Phrasing. She looked amazing in that outfit, though. That was a badass looking outfit that she was wearing.
Yeah.
And I wanted to point out that Colbert just casually rolled into Stamets' lab like he wasn't trying to cause any drama is some bullshit.
Right.
You don't just go, oh, just came in here looking for oh, no, Stamets, you're in your own lab?
Just put on my nice H&M blazer, looking good,
yeah,
looking fly.
My bad. I didn't know you were going to be in here. Hope this doesn't cause drama. No, that is trying to cause drama.
Speaking of, well, not causing drama, but deflating potential drama, I really appreciated the next scene when Nan and Burnham come to a good, respectful understanding about what happened in the last episode. Because as you remember, Nan was the one who ejected Arium into space because Burnham really couldn't do it. And you'd think there would be conflict there, but this was very Star Trek. This was very progressive future ideals of Star Trek, that we understand that we're all in this together and we have to make the hard choices. Yeah.
It was a very brief scene, and it was one of the more powerful scenes in this episode.
Yeah.
It was just...
Less is more.
And it was nice to get a little bit more of a reveal of Nan and where that character is coming from, that she was reflecting on that situation and a little bit, you know, beat up about it. And once again, not talking to anyone, no therapists. So she just is trying to cope with this in her way and reflecting on what Burnham was saying. And Burnham similarly was recognizing that Nan had the strength to do something that she couldn't, and there is power in what she was able to do, and she, you know, she's like, props to you.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah. I mean, all throughout Star Trek, the theme that all of Starfleet is a body, and everyone is an important limb or appendage or part of the body, and has different specialties and can do other things, has been a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And this scene was definitely about that, about respecting your coworkers, I guess. And it was great.
I hope, you know, as we continue to work with each other, Mike, you know, mm-hmm. either on this podcast or outside of it, you reflect on that a bit more and you start respecting me a bit more. You son of a bitch.
Next scene.
On the flip side, let's talk Next about Saru and Leela scene. Getting along swimmingly.
Dude, Saru was so savvy in this because, you know, he knows Pike is – this guy's not going to stick around. He's got a nice Enterprise being retrofit.
Saru did what I thought everyone on the Discovery ship would do, yeah. is just go there to keep an eye on people.
Right. And he's got his eye back on the captain's chair, Saru. He's like, I got to go. I'm going to go find out for myself. What is happening in Section 31? I'm going to follow this motherfucker, this shady motherfucker, on this shady fucking futuristic ship and figure out what's happening because I need to protect my crew. And guess what? If I get more intel about Section 31, that's going to help me when I become captain. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, you're dead on. And when Saru stands up to Leland and then just towers over that guy, I was like, oh, what a great scene. And Leland, it's like this power move.
True, but Leland is the most non-threatening bad guy, like, ever.
I actually didn't really like Saru vouching for Leland in a way. He's like, you know, I don't have my ganglia, so I can recognize when there's threat, but I do think that you are looking out for your best interest of everyone. I'm like, no, shut up. Shut up, Saru. I don't want to trust that guy. I don't like him. He's bad news.
Yeah.
He's our new target villain. And that's the way I want it. So don't you vouch for him so that I can feel bad for the guy later when he's you know, yeah. opening up to Burnham about some shit he went through.
Saru, we want that guy's eyes to be poked out by Skynet, all right?
Eyes poked out, nose punched out, just, yeah. you know, just wrecked.
Just hurt the face.
Just hurt the face. That's all we're asking.
So this is the same scene where he reveals to Burnham everything about her parents.
Yeah, it was a tag team interrogation yeah. by everyone just rolling in there.
For the TNG fans over there, I was thinking Leland is to Burnham's parents. Well, Leland is to Burnham what Picard was to Wesley Crusher. Because Wesley Crusher's dad was killed in... Basically, Picard got Wesley Crusher's dad killed because he was leading a mission and he sent them into danger like this.
Oh, that sounds so crushing.
All right.
Nope, not.
I respect you so much, Grant, that I'm going to let that slide.
Ah, see, it's working.
Not that I can't do anything. yeah, Burnham learns secrets about her parents. Her parents built the suit, and oh my gosh.
They're
time crystals.
This is the one thing I definitely wrote about this.
From Superman.
Time crystals?
From Superman.
What the fuck? Why are they called time crystals? Is that, like, super ridiculous?
Maybe that comes from Trek lore. I don't remember. Forgive me, listener.
They straight up said, the one thing we need in order to make this time travel suit work is time crystals.
That has to be something that's left over from the original series. That just sounds like bonkers original series bullshit.
The one thing, Mike, I need
yeah?
for my bajillion-dollar money-making suit
right.
is a bajillion dollar crystal. I just need that. Come on.
And that's what the Klingons want most.
His writing is tight, but what was that?
That was silly. But, I mean, sure, I'm trying to defend
it. Just give it a different name, and I would be okay with it.
It has to be stuck to Trek lore. It has to be. I'm going to look it up. I didn't look it up tonight, but I'm not going to look it up now.
Give me those, dilithium, or Star Wars lightsaber ones.
Oh, yeah. What is that called? I don't remember what those are called. Those are something else.
Anyway, she punches his nose a couple times, and that was great.
It was great.
It was cathartic for me in a way. I was like, I need him to just be punched in the face a little bit. Mike apparently needed more. You needed him to also have his eyes gouged out.
He did.
Yeah. Yeah. Success.
I mean, they could have cut off his head.
Wow.
Sorry. So bloodthirsty. I've been watching Supernatural lately, and there's a decapitation scene in every episode.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm desensitized.
Oh, wow.
So
then there's
Sonequa was great in this scene.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I mean, She was great this whole episode, but this scene was the turn where she realizes the burden, one of the big burdens she's been carrying her entire life, the death of her parents, is false. It wasn't her fault. And I thought she played it really brilliantly. It really affected me.
How she processes that information in real time and absorbs what he says, and at first is just kind of like, oh, wow, that's heavy. And then it was like, wait a minute here. Mm-hmm. Hold up. Let me break this down and run this back by you. So you're saying you got my parents killed? What the fuck? Yeah, it was great. And once again, yeah, that guy just getting a punch to the face. Great stuff.
And next, I think Ash walks in, right?
Yeah, everyone's just walking in.
Yeah. And he's
like, they were researching in the break room or some shit. Yeah. I don't know.
And I don't remember what the scene was, but basically he's just standing for Section 31 again, like he does.
Yeah, he came by to talk to her, but it seemed like she just needed a punching bag, an emotional punching bag. And so she just kind of starts laying it out to him. And basically it was like, you know what? I can't trust that you can be a good person and work for the Trump administration. I mean, for Section 31.
Right.
And it just doesn't jive with me. And yeah, she just kind of like lays it pretty hard on him and then like pieces out. And so I thought that laying the groundwork there so that later she can come back and be like, I can't have things end this way, was a pretty good call for the story.
Sure. I'm just not really feeling Ash very much, which is fine. This season's not really his story.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like they have him a little bit floundering, and it's a shame given that he was so integral to the first season.
So we get therapy for Culber, something Mariah has been calling for, and since she said that, we're like, yeah, people on this ship need therapy.
Wasn't that actually a great scene?
Yes, it was a great scene. Cornwell was great.
I think I was a little bit hard on her last week.
Yeah.
But I was more hard on like what the plot was that she had to carry out.
We found her strength because last season she gave Lorca, tried to give Lorca some good therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Her strength is being written as a therapist. I mean, she, talking to Culber, she understands him. She uses statements that he needs to hear, language that he needs to hear. She uses the right phrasing for him. It's good. She helps lead him in a direction with that he really wants to go. You know, she becomes a helper to him, a helper that he really needed, and gave him some great trauma therapy. He felt seen, you could tell.
Yeah, it was here's a 2-minute therapy session I can just kind of hand you.
Yeah. I'll just Venmo you for this. Thanks.
I hope that she will recognize that, oh man, you know, a lot of these people on the ship kind of need some help.
Yeah.
I know I'm an admiral, but maybe I'm going to retire and just like hang out here and just do a little light therapy work on all these people.
I would love to see more therapy scenes like this.
What a welcome addition it would be. She was fantastic. And it's a great insight into what these different characters might be going through to have that the vehicle of a therapist on ship for us, the audience.
Yeah.
I think it's just great for audiences to be exposed to more therapy work anyway.
Right. Next, we have.
Oh, meanwhile, after that whole therapy session, you go, you know who else could use some therapy? Cut to Burnham punching a punching bag angrily.
Yes.
Working out her issues physically.
Yes, and Spock just shows up just reiterating all of her pain in like
in such a monotone
way.
I'm Spock, I might be on the spectrum, and I'm just going to deliver your pain to you here. Without seeming to have any understanding of it.
But this was a great scene. I mean, he ends up showing a little solidarity in what she's going through. He says, he's kind of like, hey, I would have loved to seen you hit that bastard. You know, he's still trying to be a good brother, even though he's, you know, he's Spock.
That was good. Yeah, yeah. It was a good sibling bonding moment. Mm-hmm. And
he also gives good trauma therapy to Burnham here. He lets her off the hook for she always felt that she brought her guilt into their home and made it, you know, kind of a volatile place. And they seem to start making or creating a bridge here, which feels very earned. I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And Spock, you know, this is a scene also when Spock is like, you know, I'm bonding with you now. We're feeling a little better. By the way, we can trap the Red Angel if we kill you.
Right. Way to pull that under the rug.
Yeah.
It was kind of another ridiculous plot.
This shit was messy.
Just to be like, you know what we should do? We're going to strap you to a chair and poison you to death in front of all of your friends and loved ones and the audience, and it's going to be graphic and terrible.
I didn't expect it to be that graphic, but we'll jump to it soon.
Yeah.
We talk about the grandfather paradox.
Mm-hmm. Gonna trap Burnham.
Yep. When the guardian Red Angel, they're calling it now, always intervenes when Michael is in trouble. Not in season one, but okay. Let's put Burnham in danger. It's a big risk for Burnham. Really had me wonder what was going to happen at this point, because I was still leaving room for the idea that it was future time traveling Burnham that we're going to see, even though I also left room for that being a fake out. But I was on edge for it. I wanted to see what would happen. Would they really put her in that situation? How far would it go? Would she die? What would happen?
Yeah, with episodes like this, you know, whenever we see the lead character in mortal peril, we can generally feel a certain degree of safety because there's the confidence that they're not going to kill off the lead character.
But it was edgier than that because she could have been replaced by the future version of her.
Ah.
Right?
I mean, I didn't really consider that.
I think the threat was a little more real here.
I want to jump over real quick, and I didn't get a chance to actually look this up, so I'm not sure if this is the case.
But Vulcans are the ones with pointy ears. Klingons have the head ridges.
Okay, that was my only question. Thank you so much. Commander Nilsson, or Agent Nilsson, I don't know what her rank is.
Yes.
Is that Arium without the makeup?
No.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say that is so ridiculous.
Lieutenant Nelson. Everybody gives her the death stare as she walks into Arium's, you know,
position. Yeah, not very inviting, position. Guys.
No. But you know what's weird? The actress who played Nilsson played Arium in season one.
What?
And it was a different actress playing her in season two.
Okay, so it is still Arium in a way.
Kind of.
Like, look, we found a way for you to stay on the show.
Yeah.
And take the spot without all that makeup work.
But it was weird knowing that, because I read a few interviews with the actor who played Arium this season, and she mentioned, this other actress played Arium in the first season, but I'm kind of not going to talk about why I'm playing her now.
I'm playing her just so she can die.
Pretty much.
In like two scenes, in two episodes.
Yeah. That's a little weird.
Kind of sad, but I guess they wanted to keep the other actress in the contract.
Dude, you jumped and you missed Burnham and Tyler kissing.
Oh, yeah.
That felt earned to me. I liked it.
Yeah, see, that's kind of what I was saying, though. Like, I like the relationship between them in a way. I need Burnham to have someone that she can open up to, not just in a friend way, but in a more intimate manner. And
in the bone zone way.
Yeah, in the bone zone way. And I don't know. I appreciated that whole scene.
Yeah, it works. They work together. They have chemistry. Yeah. They have history. You can feel it. It's good.
The kiss was good. It was romantic.
Yeah.
She's got a lot of wet works this episode. Tears and kisses, and she's delivering, man. MVP.
So we're going to put her on Esof 4, which is basically a death planet with a toxic atmosphere. So let's strap her to a chair.
It was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, yeah, this is the best idea, I think. This is
good.
This is going to work.
Yeah.
Can't have any easy outs.
So we talked about this earlier, but I do have a note here. What's with Giorgio and Burnham having those longing last looks? An echo? Is it an echo of the versions of themselves they used to know? And yeah, that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, but I think there's also a blossoming respect, even if it's a begrudging respect, that each has for the other person in their dynamic. I mean, they seem so much at odds all the time, but in countless times, like not countless, but numerous times, I can count them. We've seen them.
Yeah.
We've seen them actually have each other's back and help each other. So you can see that one losing the other, while at the same time they look like the doppelganger of someone they intensely loved.
Right.
It's going to have a big impact on them.
So emotionally for me, the best scene was Spike and I said it.
Drink. Everyone take a drink.
I said Spike. Spock, the character Spock, originally played by Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
Now played by Ethan Peck. Sometimes
he merged bodies with Captain Pike and they became Spike.
Spock, the Vulcan. Anyway, my favorite emotional scene was him and Michael bonding through their shared trauma. But this final sequence where they strap Michael into the chair, she's dying. Spock is basically trying to fulfill her wishes by pulling out a phaser on everybody and saying, no, we got to see this through. Basically representing her in that situation while she dies, which is just the ultimate shit. And just the way it looked, the way the trap showed up, the cinematography and art design here, the reveal, this fucking final act was amazing.
It was badass. You're right. That set and just like how they realized the space. Like, I bought into it. Fully visualized that room that she's in, the side room where they're all watching this, the people on the bridge watching from afar and feeling helpless while trying to impotently shout commands. And, like, all of it just felt like such a lived-in space. I was just so impressed with how it was designed, how it was lit, how it was shot, the emotional payoff, how it was edited. Everyone behind the scenes, everyone in the scenes all came together and just gave all the emotional punch, like all the cutaways to everyone like fighting and wanting to save her, but all obviously not giving their all, and in a way allowing Spock to be that fall guy who prevented them, so that because they all know that what the stakes are.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
They've outlined, at least for us, the audience, even though you and me, Mike, maybe we don't buy it. They've said that if they can't trap her and figure out what's going on, it could mean the fate of the entire living universe.
And it's perfect that Spock is the character to keep his finger on the button.
Yeah, for us, the audience, Spock can do no wrong, right? He's one of those infallible characters that if he's the one like taking the last stand for all living life,
right,
then we can kind of get on board that and be like, yeah, we trust you, Spock. You're going to make the right call.
I like he was like, hey, Burnham, make sure this works, because if you don't, I might get arrested again and I don't want any trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, Spock's booty in that exosuit. You see that little shot?
What?
His little spandex, black spandex booty? Not spandex. It's like more like a shiny nylon.
No, but I will go on Tumblr tonight and look for it.
Yeah, I posted a bunch of things on my Tumblr, so you can see it there.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Check it out.
I like that Michael and Ash kind of have a little Han Solo moment where she's like, Michael, she's like, I know, Mike.
Cool. I know, that was good. And like I mentioned before, the George O moment. Mm-hmm. We already talked about all that. However, on the flip side,
I respect you.
Colbert going, hey, you know, everyone else is having their emotional moments. Maybe this is time that Sam's here and I can talk. Nope, shut down.
I appreciated that so much. I was like, there's no time for this. This episode's already a mess. Come on.
Also, I love how Stamets is like, and maybe never. Maybe never is a good time.
Yeah, never.
And I was like, oh man, it's like that scene.
Did he break up with him?
No, but I think he just kind of like he established a little bit of reclaimed a little bit of power in the dynamic that I think was kind of needed. It reminded me of that scene in Scott Pilgrim where Scott Pilgrim gains self-respect. And I was like, you're actually sticking up for yourself in a situation where you need to. He can't just keep coming to you with his doubts, but at the same time, like, abusing you in a way. And I like that Sam's kind of like said, hold up. I also am a person that should be respected in this dynamic. I've also gone through some shit, and maybe never is a good time.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
I liked it.
I really liked the effects on Michael as she was kind of deteriorating. That was fucking Walking Dead shit.
You know what it was? The Day After Tomorrow shit. Because did you see that evil monster coming from the air? The air was creeping down like a monster to attack her face. Just like the cold air chases down the hallway and they have to run from the cold
air. Oh, yeah.
I was laughing. I'm like, they made the air a monster.
Like in The Happening.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's coming for you. Run.
It's the air, guys.
How she's screaming and just those wild animal guttural just noises. At first, it was a little bit comical to me that, you know, she's making kind of silly noises.
Oh,
but
it worked for me.
Yeah,
right
in conjunction
started, like,
with like
shit.
The pain and everything on her face. I'm like, oh, this is actually really heavy and really fucked up.
Yeah. Right when it happened, I was just – it took it to another level. I was really feeling that pain.
And if it wasn't enough of a wow, what the fuck moment, let's cue Leland running over to this little eye machine that stabs him. Who installed needles into this eye machine? Why would that have even been part of the design? Where those
I was
from?
Waiting for that to happen because earlier in the episode, Pike was like, this evil Skynet AI is dormant for now, but it'll definitely reassert itself sooner or later, like in this episode at the most inconvenient time, maybe when somebody's sticking their eyes in a little eye thing.
Oh, yeah, when Saru's like, hey, guys, I'm pretty sure control is gone. Like, everyone got rid of that. So I think we can all rest assured that there's no problem. Bullshit, Saru.
Well, we knew.
Bullshit.
We knew Leland had a target on his back because Giorgio needs to be the captain, right?
Is he dead or were his eyes turned milky and then they went clear again?
Maybe he got turned into like some evil cyborg.
You think?
Maybe. I mean, that's what evil AIs like to do, don't they? I've seen Superman 3.
I'm not going to feel comfortable viewing him as a villain.
What?
I'm completely comfortable with that guy being a villain. He's a great villain. Yeah. I want to agree against him.
I mean, if he's going to stay on the show and be a villain, I would like him to have more bite. So, yeah.
Right.
This would be good.
Okay, so then let's talk about that last scene. Mom?
The Red Angel is not Michael. It's her mom. WTF, that explains why it's always showing up to save her.
It's, what's her name from The Wire?
Oh, don't shit.
Yeah.
I knew who that was. What's her name?
If I had IMDb, I'd pull it up.
Yeah. I was like, this lady looks familiar.
Like seeing her on there, I'm like, okay, this is more questions. Like they did that bioscan. Can parents have the exact same bioscan DNA? I don't know how that's going to work. No.
No.
Is she a clone of her mom? She was never actually a biological kid.
Let's not put another layer of what the fuckness on this.
Her mom end up passing on the red suit for her to wear at some point during which they scan and it is Michael Burnham in the suit?
No. I think maybe the story they want to tell.
Some explanations need to be
coming. more questions.
Because they were 100% sure, and they nailed that into, hammered that into us. Not nailed that.
You don't think
us,
that's just going to be hand waved away in a throwaway line in the next episode? Man. Oh, yeah, we thought it was Michael, but yeah, the scans.
Can they stop hand waving away some of these things?
No, there's a story to tell, Grant.
All right, fair enough.
I'm excited to see where this goes. It was definitely a twist that it felt a little bit like twist for twist's sake, but I'm still pretty excited. It pulled me in. I'm ready for next week. I want to see where the story goes. I want to see how much more pain we can squeeze out of Michael Burnham.
Mommy issues are great to explore. I mean,
I want to see Michael Burnham's mom butt heads with Giorgio, who's kind of maybe a mother figure to Michael.
Oh, and then bring Amanda in there too. The three moms.
Oh yeah,
episode.
Amanda. We haven't seen her in a while. Yeah, that'd be good.
Oh yeah, they can all fight over her. There's. I had one more question. This is outside of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So, do they take and wrap up these corpses and just shoot them all off into space, and they're all just zipping past each other?
Always.
Is it just a bunch of corpses that, like, oh, we just had an impact? Can you get a read on that?
Sir, there was it was another corpse that kind of blasted. Yeah, never mind, guys. It was just an asteroid.
Space
Let's
is a
not
graveyard.
Talk about a corpse just blasting into our ship.
It's supposed to be like a sea burial, you know, but it's
right.
In space. Yeah.
Seems kind of dark because they're putting them in something that doesn't seem like it's going to biodegrade because there's no bio.
They come back and they blow it up later when nobody's looking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel a little bit, maybe like it explodes out in space.
There's a ship that goes around the universe and blows up all the little corpse ships.
There's a corpse
it's a dirty
barge
job.
That just like collects them.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Just pew pew. Okay. We're doing some awards.
Yeah. So
a new segment.
Yeah, we had this idea, and we're obviously introducing it way too late in the season. But, like, what if we were to just kind of pick our favorites from the episode and give an award to, I think, it should be one for the cast,
mm-hmm.
and then one for something we liked behind the scenes.
The crew.
Yeah, the crew.
Okay, MVP cast. Fucking Michael Burnham.
Yeah.
Fucking Sonequa Martin-Green killing it in every episode, having to, what do you know, carry this episode on her shoulders, just like her character.
Yeah, you said every episode, but you mean every scene
every
of this
scene,
episode.
Yes, every scene this, of this
like,
episode.
I agree. Like, every episode as well, she's just fantastic. But this was her episode here. She was incredible. She had to do so much, like, heavy drama, and she had to balance all these different emotions going on. With all these different variables, with her relationship with Giorgio, her relationship with Ash, her relationship with Leland and the truth, and her situation with her mom, with dying, like all of it was so heavy, and she makes us follow and believe in this storyline, which is so impressive to do. I was blown away by her performance so much in this episode that yeah. I agree with you. We have to give her the award here.
Yeah. What does she get? We tweet at her and say you want an award, come pick it up in Austin, Texas?
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. We can make a little graphic and send it to her.
Okay.
If she wants it, she's like, no, I'm good, thanks.
I got lines to memorize, guys. Okay, MVP behind the scenes, and I think we're of the same mind of this.
Yeah, this is a little tricky, mm-hmm. but I think we both agree that you know, just with how much had to be balanced and figured out and all these right, delicate moments captured perfectly, this has just got to go to the director.
Yeah, Culpepper. Handle him, Culpepper.
Right.
Yeah. So much. I mean, for something like this to work, obviously the script is just jam-packed and it's kind of messy. But for something like this to work where it is running at warp speed, and you have every character, almost every character in this series, having a pivotal role or a couple pivotal scenes. The performances have to be modulated so well, and not just Sonequa, who did a great job, but everyone here was just pulling it off magnificently. Everybody kept the pacing going. Then, and that you know comes down to the director.
Yeah, props to the top. And I think it's kind of ridiculous that we introduced a new segment about awards and then we give it to the lead actor, actress, and then the director. It seems like we're not really drilling deep here.
Wonder who's going to get it next week.
Well, oh, looks like you two won again.
Well, now we're doing our personal MVPs other than our, you know, our the consensus.
All right, so, you go first.
Okay. For me, it was Michelle Yeoh. I've been missing her for a couple episodes, and she came back, and finally, she, throughout the entire episode, she was full-on Giorgio, but also Giorgio, who is growing, learning, changing. She was in a room in every episode. She was in a room where she didn't have to hide the fact that she was the emperor.
Right.
So she could be her full-on manipulative, you know, emperor self, and it was great. I mean, she chewed that scenery so well, the way she was manipulating everybody. She was just having a fucking blast. And this episode was really funny. Like, the first half of it was really funny. And she got all the funny lines. And she delivered them so well. Michelle Yeoh, I don't really remember her being known as a comic actor. But she did a great job with the comedy here.
Such great levity. Such great snark.
Yeah.
Fun lines for her to deliver. And she just chewed it all up perfectly.
Sassy, snarky. She is my personal MVP.
My personal MVP, I think I'm going to give it to the set design for that last piece.
Yeah.
I love how the what's the planet called? Essos 4 or Ephos? I don't know.
Ephos 4, I believe.
How they visualize this room where they constructed all of these Ghostbuster magnets to catch the Red Angel and the chair in the middle. It was all very graphic, very sensational, almost a little operatic, it felt. And and how they visualized that space along with the room to the side where everyone sat a little bit helpless, held hostage by Spock. It all... I really liked the environment that was constructed there and how the set designers made this playground that was able to be shot in a way that allowed so much drama to be drawn out of that scene. I was very impressed.
So you like that more than Spock's butt?
Oh, man. Like, can I just give an MVP to his butt?
Because you mentioned that earlier.
I was impressed by that, not an MVP.
Oh, okay, not an MVP. All right. Number two for you.
Oh, God.
Okay, I think we've discussed this episode to death. But, you know, we probably just hit the surface because, guys, we just watched this. And we, as you know, we jump on the mics right after we watch the episode. So if you have more to say, find us at Twitter, at Star Trek Pod. We'll continue to discuss this episode. If you want to discuss it even more in depth with us, you can go to patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Give us $2 an episode, and you can join our private Slack community. There's tons of pod listeners and Star Trek fans talking Star Trek Discovery, talking Star Trek with us all day, every day. It's a good time.
Yeah, and if you want to call me out personally, either do it on that Slack channel, or you can find me at Baron Von Grant over on Twitter. I know it's outside of the wheelhouse of Trekkies to point out errors made in any sort of discussion of this. But
never happens.
But you may be that one weird anomaly, that Trekkie who is outspoken about keeping – just call me out on that. And I will gladly accept that I have made mistakes on this podcast.
What have you done? What have you done? You can find me at Mike Moody on Twitter and visit us at StarTrekPod.com. Listen to our back catalog. Support us. We would love you for it. Live long and prosper.